There could be no doubt that the Hittite pantheon and tales of the gods indeed had their roots in Sumer, its civilization and its gods. The tale of the challenge to the divine throne continues to relate heroic battles, but of an inconclusive nature. At one point, the failure of Teshub to defeat his adversary even caused his spouse to attempt suicide. Finally, an appeal was made to the gods to mediate the dispute, and an assembly of the gods was called. It was led by an olden god named Enlil, and another olden god named Ea, who was called upon to produce the old tablets with the words of destiny, some ancient records that could apparently help settle the dispute regarding the divine succession. Who were these olden gods? All of them bear Sumerian names. Even the name Teshub, as well as the names of other Hittite gods, were often written in Sumerian script to denote their identities. Also, some of the places named in the action were those of ancient Sumerian sites. It dawned on the scholars that the Hittites, in fact, worshipped a pantheon of Sumerian origins. Now, when the Hittites reached Babylon sometime after 1600 BC, the Sumerians were already long gone from the Near Eastern scene. How was it then that their language, literature, and religion dominated another great kingdom in another millennium and in another part of Asia? The bridge scholars have recently discovered were a people called Hurrians, referred to in the Old Testament as Horites, meaning free people. They dominated the wide area between Sumer and Akkad in Mesopotamia and the Hittite kingdom in Anatolia. Egyptian and Mesopotamian royal documents referred to the Hurrian kingdom as Mitanni and dealt with it on an equal footing, a strong power whose influence spread beyond its immediate borders. The Hittites called their Hurrian neighbors Hurri. These Hurrians dominated the Hittites culturally and religiously. The Hittites acquired their cosmology, their myths, their gods, and their pantheon of 12 from the Hurrians. Since the culture and religion were only a development of the original Sumerian traditions and beliefs, the Hurrians, in fact, absorbed and transmitted the religion of Sumer. The epic tales, it has become clear, were the tales of Sumer, the dwelling place of the olden gods, where Sumerian cities, the olden language, was the language of Sumer. Even the Hurrian art duplicated Sumerian art, its form, its themes, and its symbols. Evidence suggests that the Hurrians, who were the northern neighbors of Sumer and Akkad in the second millennium BC, had actually commingled with Sumerians in the previous millennium. In the 13th century BC, under the pressure of vast migrations and invasions, including the Israelite thrust from Egypt to Canaan, the Hurrians retreated to the northeastern portion of their kingdom. There, they worshipped a pantheon headed by Teshub, depicting him as a vigorous god wearing a horned cap and standing upon his cult symbol, the bull. What about the other avenue by which the tales and worship of gods reached Greece, from the eastern shores of the Mediterranean via Crete and Cyprus? The lands that are today Israel, Lebanon, and southern Syria, which formed the southwestern band of the ancient Fertile Crescent, were then the habitat of people that can be grouped together as Canaanites. The Canaanite language was what scholars call West Semitic, a branch of a group of languages which also includes the earliest Akkadian and present-day Hebrew. The language, literary style, and terminology are reminiscent of the Old Testament. The pantheon that unfolds from the Canaanite text bears many similarities to the later Greek one. Whence had the Canaanites, for their part, drawn their culture and religion? Well, the Old Testament considered them a part of the Hamitic family of nations with roots in the hot lands of Africa, brothers of the Egyptians. The artifacts and written records unearthed by archaeologists confirm the close affinity between the two, as well as the many similarities between the Canaanite and Egyptian deities. The many national and local gods, the multitude of their names and epithets, the diversity of their roles, emblems, and animal mascots, at first cast the gods of Egypt as an unfathomable crowd of actors upon a strange stage. But a closer look reveals that they were essentially no different from those in the other lands of the ancient world. The Egyptians believed in gods of heaven and earth, great gods that were clearly distinguished from the multitude of lesser deities. G.A. Wainwright summed up the evidence showing that the Egyptian belief in gods of heaven who descended to earth from the skies was extremely ancient. The The Egyptian word for divine being or God was Enter, which means one who watches. Significantly, that is exactly the meaning of the name Sumer, the land of the ones who watch. The earlier notion that civilization may have begun in Egypt has been discarded by now. There's ample evidence showing that the Egyptian organized society and civilization, which began half a millennium and more after the Sumerian one, drew its culture, architecture, technology, art of writing, and the many other aspects of a high civilization from Sumer. The weight of evidence also shows that the gods of Egypt originated in Sumer. Cultural and blood kinsmen of the Egyptians, the Canaanites shared the same gods with them, but situated in a land strip that was a bridge between Asia and Africa from time immemorial, the Canaanites also came under strong Semitic and Mesopotamian influences. Like the Hittites to the north, the Hurrians to the northeast, the Egyptians to the south, the Canaanites could not boast of an original pantheon. They too acquired their cosmogony, their deities, their legendary tales from elsewhere. Their direct contacts with the Sumerian sources were the Amorites. The lands of the Amorites lay between Mesopotamia and the Mediterranean lands of Western Asia. In the 1930s, archaeologists came upon the center and capital city of the Amorites, known as Mari. At a bend of the Euphrates, where the Syrian border now cuts the river, the diggers uncovered a major city whose buildings were erected and continuously re-erected between 3000 and 2000 BC on foundations that date to centuries earlier. These earliest remains included a step pyramid and temples of the Sumerian deities. The palace of Mari alone occupied some 5 acres and included a throne room painted with the most striking murals, 300 various rooms, scribal chambers, and well over 20,000 tablets in the cuneiform script, dealing with the economy, trade, politics, and social life of those times, with state and military matters, and of course, with the religion of the land and its people. Among the finds at Mari, as elsewhere in the lands of Sumer, there were dozens of statues of the people themselves, kings, nobles, priests, singers. They were invariably depicted with their hands clasped in prayer, their gaze frozen forever toward their gods. Who were these gods of heaven and earth, divine yet human, always headed by a pantheon or inner circle of 12 deities? We have entered the temples of the Greeks and the Aryans, the Hittites and the Hurrians, the Canaanites, the Egyptians and the Amorites. We have followed paths that took us across continents and seas and clues that carried us over several millennia. All of the corridors of all of the temples have led us to one source, Sumer. There were, the Sumerians believed, gods that were of the heavens. Texts dealing with the time before things were created talk of such heavenly gods. As we look closer at these gods, we shall realize that they were the celestial bodies that make up our solar system. There were also lesser gods that were of earth. Between the two groups, there were gods of heaven and earth, the ones called the ancient gods. They were the olden gods of the epic tales, and in the Sumerian belief, they had come down to earth from the heavens. These were no mere local deities. They were national gods, indeed international gods. Some of them were present and active upon the earth even before there were men upon the earth. Indeed, the very existence of man was deemed to have been the result of a deliberate creative enterprise on the part of these gods. They were powerful, capable of feats beyond mortal ability and comprehension, yet these gods not only looked like humans, but ate and drank like them and displayed virtually every human emotion of love and hate, loyalty and infidelity. The head of this family of gods of heaven and earth was An, or Anu in the Babylonian Assyrian text. He was the great father of the gods, the king of the gods. His symbol was a star. In the Sumerian pictographic writing, the sign of a star also stood for An, for heaven, and for divine being or God. Anu's abode and the seat of his kingdom was in the heavens. That is where the other gods of heaven and earth went when they needed individual advice or favor, or where they met in assembly to settle disputes among themselves or to reach major decisions. Numerous texts describe Anu's palace, whose portals were guarded by a god of the tree of truth and a god of the tree of life. The Sumerian texts recall instances when not only the other gods, but even some chosen mortals were permitted to go up to Anu's abode, mostly with the object of escaping mortality. Now, one such tale pertained to Adapa, model of man. He was so perfect and so loyal to the god Ea, who had created him, that Ea arranged for him to be taken to Anu. The Sumerians claimed that not only gods, but also selected mortals could ascend to the divine abode in the heavens, and that's echoed in the New Testament tales of the ascents to the heavens by Enoch and the prophet Elijah. After Anu, the second most powerful deity of the Sumerian pantheon was Enlil. His name meant Lord of the Airspace, the prototype and father of the later storm gods that were to head the pantheons of the ancient world. He was Anu's eldest son, born at his father's heavenly abode, but at some point in the earliest times, he descended to earth and was thus the principal god of heaven and earth. Not only the Sumerians, but the very gods of Sumer considered Enlil supreme. They called him ruler of all the lands and made it clear that in heaven he is the prince, on earth he is the chief. Enlil, according to Sumerian beliefs, arrived on earth well before earth became settled and civilized. A hymn to Enlil recounts the many aspects of society and civilization that would not have existed had it not been for Enlil's instruction to execute his orders far and wide. A portion of the hymn reads like this. No cities would be built, no settlements founded, no stalls would be built, no sheepfolds erected, no king would be raised, no high priest born. The Sumerians revered Enlil out of both fear and gratitude. It was he who made sure that decrees by the assembly of the gods were carried out against mankind. It was his wind that blew obliterating storms against offending cities. It was he who, at the time of the deluge, sought the destruction of mankind. But when at peace with mankind, he was a friendly god who bestowed favors, according to the Sumerian text, and knowledge of farming, together with the plow and the pickaxe, were granted to mankind by Enlil. Enlil also selected the kings who were to rule over mankind, not as sovereigns, but as servants of the god entrusted with the